From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
My name is Karen Briskin, calling from Florida.
Karen is a licensed massage therapist. She'd been doing that work for 12 years until Floridians were told to stay at home due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
In order to do what I do, by definition, I am in close contact with my clients. In order to practice my craft, I would be required to defy public health recommendations.
And of course, she's not defying those recommendations. Karen misses the rhythms, the basic human interactions of daily life. She misses her work, but she doesn't know when it will be safe to open her business again. And she's wondering, how is she supposed to know?
If I go back into practice, do I provide a negative test result to every client? If I got one yesterday, but I've been in contact with clients, am I still negative? I don't know. Do I require my clients to provide proof of negative test results? How frequently?
And even when she does get to go back to work, there's another question weighing on Karen's mind.
And for so many who have reduced or no income, could they even afford it? Really, getting your nails done, getting a massage, although I think it's essential for well-being, is that going to be the first expense you add back to your list?
Just some of the many questions that many millions of Americans have on their minds. So this hour on Point, questions about next steps in Quarantine Nation. And in order to help us answer those questions, we're going to turn to Rebecca Katz. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's researched quarantines for the past 10 years. And Rebecca, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me back.
The reason why I emphasize the welcome back is because we last talked to you about 6 weeks ago on March 10th, which I can say with complete honesty feels like six lifetimes ago. I actually want to play for you a question and answer from that March 10th show. Some news from Washington and California that they had stay-in-place orders already in effect. But I asked you, like, if you could imagine seeing that across the United States. And here's that interaction. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we might see the kind of large-scale quarantines that we've had in China and Italy? Could those come to the United States?
They might. And I think I don't imagine it would be a blanket statement, though.
So, Rebecca, that was 6 weeks ago. how have you felt about what you've seen since then?
Well, first, I would echo the sentiment that it may be 6 weeks ago, but it feels like lifetimes ago. I think what we're clearly living in a unique time, and many of the actions that are being taken are unprecedented. But I will say that I think I, along with many public health officials across the country, have been really impressed by how seriously the majority of the country has taken the physical distancing orders, the importance of staying home, and the importance of protecting the most vulnerable in society as we enable the healthcare community to work. So I think it's been really interesting to see how much people are abiding by public health messages, but there also remains a lot of variability across the country, and we can do a little bit of monitoring through the through technology. So we've been able to look through the cell phone mobility data to see which states are staying home more than others. There's clearly some variation in each jurisdiction's rules about what's allowed and what's mm-hmm. not allowed. And I think it's important to reinforce the idea that one stay-at-home order is not the same as another.
Right.
So in some locations, it's stay at home except to go to work, or except to go, you know, to visit a family member. In other localities, if you are on the road, you might get pulled over because law enforcement is going to be asking you where you're going and why. So I think all of us can Normally, exercise is allowed. And so, but you can go outside, you can go into your neighborhood, and you're going to see different people practicing physical distancing very differently. Mm-hmm. So, I'll go for a walk and I'm driving my family crazy because I get upset at anybody who's not doing things the right way. but some places you'll see everybody wearing some type of face covering. In other environments, you won't. Even when there's a order to stay, say, 6 feet apart in a grocery store, you may see some people not necessarily doing that.
Yeah.
So, or you may go for a walk and you'll find people congregating. And so it's really hard. I think overall, it's been very impressive to see how seriously everybody is taking this and how at great sacrifice to themselves, with economic hardships, with all sorts of mental challenges that come along with this type of isolation. So this has been really mm-hmm. difficult for many people, but most folks are really taking this seriously.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because we should underscore it that this has been taken very seriously by many millions of people here in the United States. And then at the same time, there has been a lack of consistency across the country. And to, you know, Rebecca, in your defense, that's basically what you did say on March 10th, that you didn't imagine it would be like a blanket, there would be uniformity across the country. But so here we are now, 6 mm-hmm. weeks later, and we are seeing at the federal level, even at the state level in certain places, questions being asked about how an orderly relaxation of some of these shelter-in-place or stay-at-home guidelines would come about. So let me ask you, what are the right questions to be asking right now? Because people have hundreds of different questions about how to do this. But what would you say is like the right two or three questions that we ought to be focusing on?
Well, maybe I might expand that to three or four questions.
Okay.
So first, I think that the federal government released the end of last week their plan for reopening America, and with different phases. But to me, the most important piece of that document was the gating criteria that were put forward. This notion that, okay, we need to start planning, we need to start thinking about how we're going to reopen society. But before we do any of that, we really need to make sure that we're meeting certain criteria. And those criteria were severalfold, that you would have to have a reduction in cases over the period of about 2 weeks. So whether that's reported cases or even just, symptomatic cases, that you would have to ensure that your healthcare system was not overwhelmed and were sufficiently supplied with personal protective equipment and ventilators and anything that they would need, and that they weren't overwhelmed with their number of beds. That you would then have to have sufficient testing in place, and then the ability to do contact tracing, isolation, quarantine, and ideally treatment. And if you have all those things in place, then we can start thinking about the different ways that you would relax some of the physical distancing orders and how to start reopening segments of society. So I would first say that I don't really think there's anywhere in the country yet that has met those gating criteria.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing aggressive planning for how to reopen different parts of the economy, of society, or that the political and economic pressures are going to be such that, it's not hypothetical, we're already seeing it, that different political leaders are going to start taking actions to reopen things anyway, even if those gating criteria aren't met.
Right. So can I just jump in here? Because I wanted to just play for you a little bit of what Dr. Anthony Fauci said at yesterday's White House daily briefing about the steps, really, that in his words, basically what you just said, Rebecca, but here's Anthony Fauci talking about the steps that need to be taken to reopen businesses, and that they must be done in a careful and measured way.
So what has happened is that the mitigation that we put in with the first 15 days and then the 30-day mitigation program of physical distancing worked. So it got us to where we are today. It is a successful formula. It is the basis for our being able to say that we can now think seriously about reopening America.
Rebecca, well, how significant was it that Dr. Fauci in particular said that yesterday?
Well, I mean, he continues to be the voice of reason, the voice of evidence, and somebody that we all look to for advice in this pandemic. So I think it's incredibly important, and he's correct. The entire purpose of all of these measures was in some ways to, it's almost like a control alt delete, right? We needed to be able to reset. We needed to be able to had and continue to have widespread community transmission of the virus. And we needed to be able to get it under control enough to be able to start taking very targeted measures. So I think he's absolutely right. The measures of the physical distancing, the quarantine, the isolation, all that has helped. We are not seeing the type of exponential growth that we were seeing weeks ago. We're still though seeing growth, mm-hmm. and I think that's one of the challenges that we need to be facing right now. And while we are still seeing growth, we also don't yet have the infrastructure in place on the public health side and on the diagnostic testing side to be able to then handle these, you know, the increases in cases we know we're going to see when we start relaxing the measures.
Okay, so later in the show, then, we're going to talk about what that fact means for what we might see policy-wise in the coming year or possibly even longer. So, Rebecca Katz, stand by for just a second. We are talking about next steps in Quarantine Nation. We have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about next steps in Quarantine Nation. And I'm joined today by Rebecca Katz. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's researched quarantines for the past decade. And here is what Dr. Deborah Birx said at Tuesday's coronavirus task force briefing. She was talking about businesses in some places that could reopen as long as people practice safe social distancing outlined in the president's guidelines for phase one.
I mean, we've been very clear in the guidelines, and I think it's up to the governors and mayors to ensure that they're following the best they can each of those phases, to make sure that both the public is completely protected. But the governors and mayors also need to communicate very clearly on the data that was used for decision making and make that transparent and available to their community.
That's Dr. Deborah Birx talking about phase one of the president's guidelines or the president's reopening plan. Now, I want to spend a minute or two talking about some of the protests that have popped up here and there across the United States to reopen the economy. And joining us now is Isaac Stanley Becker. He is Washington Post national political reporter joining us from Washington. Isaac, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So these protests aren't necessarily large. And as you heard Rebecca and I talking about before, the vast majority of Americans are following these physical distancing guidelines. So I wanted to ask you, Isaac, what do we know about who's organizing these anti-lockdown protests?
That's right. The vast majority of people are following the guidelines, and the vast majority of people and the vast majority of Republicans support stay-at-home orders. But we have seen scattered protests breaking out across the country, especially outside of state capitol buildings. And what we found in our reporting is that this is in many cases being coordinated and amplified by powerful and in certain cases well-funded conservative networks, including groups that were set up with funding from powerful Republican mega donors like Robert Mercer.
And what is their intent? What is their point? Can we suss that out?
Well, they have a range of interests in this. They are supportive of the president, for one, and fear the consequences of prolonged economic difficulties for his reelection prospects. There is a strain of anti-government and anti-expert and anti-science sentiment in all of this. Experts I spoke to liken this activity not just to the Tea Party movement, but also to decades of climate denialism that attacked big government and attacked science. And we are certainly seeing some of that here in the pushback against these public health precautions that epidemiologists and experts just widely agree are necessary to contain this coronavirus.
So this is an extension then of the chaos. It's deliberate chaos, I feel like they're trying to cause. Small as it might be right now, but as you were saying, it's an extension of the science denialism that has been deeply funded by small groups of wealthy people or wealthy organizations for some time.
I think that's certainly an important part of it. And that's also not to say that there aren't, people who have grave and deeply felt concerns about the economic effects of this, the effects on their own livelihood. And I should also say that there are people who are involved in these protests who are clearly doing their best to follow the rules. Some of these protests have been kind of drive-in or drive-by protests where people have stayed in their cars. Some of it has spilled over, and people have broken some of those guidelines. And we've seen states try to crack down on that. And we've also seen in places people are coming heavily armed. So this is overlapping with the gun rights movement in a somewhat striking way.
And Isaac, last question for you here. I wonder how does it impact, or what impact does the president himself have when, for example, he just recently essentially criticized Georgia Governor Brian Kemp for wanting to reopen, and the president saying, well, now it's too soon, whereas it was just a couple of days ago or weeks ago that the president was, tweeting out, liberate.
Right. Well, we are seeing, of course, contradictory messages from the White House and from the president in particular. He had been, cheering on governors about getting their economies going, not just by May 1st, but before May 1st. As you said, he was tweeting out to people to liberate their states. And then we saw him try to second guess the Georgia governor's moves yesterday. So, it's a bit hard to pin down on any given day exactly where the president stands on this. But it's no doubt that these protesters feel as if they've been, given the go-ahead and sanctioned by, his calls on social media.
Mm. Well, Isaac Stanley Becker, Washington Post national political reporter, joining us from the nation's capital. Thank you so much, Isaac, for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Rebecca Katz, let me turn back to you. The reason why we wanted to spend just a couple of minutes on that is that if you're a policymaker in the United States, there are, there's a tumultuous mix of interests and perspectives, right, that you have to take into account when trying to understand or make decisions about relaxing stay-at-home guidelines. How concerning is it to you that we are seeing some well-funded groups or wealthy individuals trying to foment protest, even if the numbers themselves aren't that large right now?
Well, I think it's deeply concerning just from the public health perspective. While absolutely correct, some of the protesters are taking precautions themselves to stay safe, some aren't. So I think the message just purely on the public health side is very disturbing to us, to see people coming out and protesting and honestly putting their own lives at risk by doing so. On the political side, I think this issue is just underscoring kind of the larger challenges that we know decision makers have is that there's a lot of different factors that have to go into to the decision making and the questions of what comes next. It is very easy for me as a public health professional to be able to say, you know, we should to look at things, you know, never quite in black and white, but as close to black and white as possible, and to say, you know, here's the things that we absolutely have to do for the public. But we also know that every decision is more complex than that. Mm-hmm. So there's economics, there's politics, there's lots of different dynamics that are at play that are all influencing the decisions that are going to be made, whether or not they are consistent with the public health guidance.
Right. So let me just play a tape for you from a On Point listener. This is Sean from Rutland, Vermont. And Sean left us a voicemail suggesting that people should take all necessary precautions. And at the same time, should the definition of essential be expanded?
When we do take the necessary precautions, things like health and wellness are essential. Things like, you know, feeling great and looking great for yourself are essential, because not only are we talking about the physical health of our people during this time, we really have to come together and understand that the mental part plays just as more of an important role in most cases.
That's Sean, an On Point listener from Rutland, Vermont. And Rebecca, the reason why I wanted to play Sean's comment there is the political protests aside, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that there is a certain measure of a quarantine fatigue. And in fact, we could have seen this coming in a conversation that we had on this show several weeks ago, when we were looking at how Singapore, Hong Kong, and other countries were managing their lockdowns. In fact, we were told from Hong Kong that you have to beware of quarantine fatigue. And I was just wondering, are you seeing that? And how should that be managed?
Well, I think we're absolutely seeing it, right? And and we also have to understand. Yeah, I mean, if it was up to me, maybe I would keep me and my family in bubble wrap for as long as possible.
Yes.
but I also, I mean, we have to be able to. We have to understand human behavior, health seeking behavior. What are everybody's priorities, and try to plan accordingly. Now. Clearly, the longer somebody stays, in their home and distance from everybody, there's a lot of mental health issues that are coming up. There's a lot of challenges, and I don't want to be the person that says, no, we should stop you from feeling good about yourself. But I think there are really important questions to be asked. So, what is the individual risk tolerance? What is the public's risk tolerance? What are the political decision makers and what their risk tolerance looks like? So it may be very important to an individual for their own mental health and well-being to get a great haircut. and right, I don't want to put judgment on that. That might be incredibly important. I tell you, I would love to go back and see my hairdresser. But it's not just you that's part of that decision calculus anymore. So it's okay, I want to get a haircut, but what does that mean for the my hairdresser? Is my hairdresser putting themselves at risk? What risk calculus are they making to be able to pay their mortgage, and willing to put themselves at risk in order for economic consequences?
Mm-hmm.
And then if I go get my hair done, I've now exposed myself, and now I bring that home, and whoever I interact with in my house or maybe at the grocery store, it's not just I think what's really important here is that for a communicable disease, we have to take, it's the individual risk and the community risk. And they're intertwined.
So there's a third one that you just talked about the risk tolerance of political decision makers. And I would posit that is, of the three, the political decision makers may have the lowest risk tolerance.
Well, they are trying to make a lot of decisions. They have a lot of pressures on them from lots of different constituents, as well as, again, the economics, the politics, the the health side, and they're trying to make decisions under uncertainty. There's a lot of information we don't have yet, and we're learning more every day, but it doesn't necessarily make it easier. Again, it's really easy for me. I know where I stand, but I also am trying to be very cognizant of the positions that other people are in and all the other factors that are have to be weighed as they think about what comes next. And because of that, I think, again, like I said, I would love to be able to keep us all in bubble wrap for just a little bit longer, but understand the realities of life, and which means that we simultaneously need to be thinking very carefully about how we, if an organization is going to reopen, if an employer is going to start having people come back to work, how do we try to do that in the safest way possible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play some more thoughts from On Point listeners, because they sent us quite a few. Here's Catherine from Springfield, Illinois, and she called us to say she is going to follow her community's stay-at-home order through April 30th.
My plan personally is to listen to the experts, look at the data about the spread of this disease, and be very cautious about going non-essential places until the experts say it's safe, rather than just going ahead and going out once restrictions are lifted.
Catherine, though, also says that she has choices in her life, and she is concerned about people who might not have those same choices, who have to weigh safety and employment.
What about the pressure on people who may not have much of a choice once these restrictions are lifted? For example, non-essential workers or people who have been termed non-essential workers during stay-at-home orders who will be ordered back to work and will find themselves without a job if they don't comply, even if they don't feel comfortable with that, even if they're immunocompromised or at risk in some way.
So that's Catherine from Springfield, Illinois. And Rebecca Katz, the reason why I like what Catherine was pointing out is that, A, there are people who are not going to have a choice, that when they can go back to work, they will. And B, I think we need to sort of step back from this notion that it's like a light switch, right? When we sort of when we decide that lockdown is over, it's not necessarily over. So it's more sort of a slow fade up, or a fading in, back in of things. And what would that fading in look like? Does it start with sending people back to work? Does it start with schools, perhaps? I mean, where would we look to begin?
Those are all excellent questions. And I think to Catherine's point, one, I'm delighted to hear that she herself is making decisions based off of the public health and medical experts. And I think there's a great effort right now to actually create a stronger evidence base, so we have more data to better inform decisions. But she's also absolutely right. It is there are a lot of people that don't have the luxury of deciding to you know, continue to socially isolate, to be physically distant, to stay in quarantine when their employer says, no, we need you back at work. And it brings up a lot of really, we have a lot of issues that we're going to have to address from a society perspective. So if you go back to work and you become sick, so one, are the employers now responsible for doing their own testing? And if so, how do they actually get that capacity? And do they feed that information back to the public health system? If you test positive while you're at work, and now you're, you know, the best practice that we can, the best guidance we can provide is that if you, to do testing early so you can identify somebody, you know, ideally, you know, before they start transmitting the disease to lots of people, and then you want to isolate that person and send them home. Can we do that? Does that person then have sick leave? Are there other incentives for them to maybe hide that they don't feel well, so they can stay employed? You know, what kind of protections do we have for people who are continuing to be identified at risk? Do they have to go back to work? Are they protected? Are employers responsible for continuing to pay them if they are in that at-risk category? again, there are a lot of issues that are coming up, and not all of them have been addressed yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back, we're going to hear from a voice from Italy on what might be the next steps there. Because, again, we're constantly trying to look at different places around the world, since we're all dealing with this together, on what we can learn from the nations that are a couple of weeks or a month ahead of us. So, Rebecca Katz, hang on here for just a moment. There's a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about next steps for Quarantine Nation. And I'm joined today by Rebecca Katz. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. Now, let's spend a couple of minutes talking about what is happening elsewhere in the world. For example, here's Jenny. She's originally from Washington, D.C. She moved to Cape Town, South Africa a few weeks before the lockdowns were put into place there. Residents in South Africa and Cape Town have been unable to go outside for 4 weeks at all without a permit, except to shop for essential needs.
For me, once this has, you know, kind of subsided, or at least it's been lifted a little bit, I'm most looking forward to going back outside. I don't think I will ever take a walk for granted again, and you can probably find me outside walking by the ocean at least once a day once this is over.
That's Jenny in Cape Town, South Africa. Now, South Africa is a nation of more than 57 million people. Currently, 3,600 total reported cases of COVID-19 and just 65 deaths. So the very restrictive measures in South Africa seeming to work for now. So now let's go to Italy, where we're joined by Anna Benstead. She's with us from Fiesole, Italy. She is a former longtime journalist here at WBUR, and also I'm going to call her On Point's Tuscany correspondent. So Anna Benstead, welcome to On Point.
Should I say buongiorno?
Buongiorno. Now, you heard Jenny there from Cape Town talking about life under extremely restrictive lockdown. Italy has had the most restrictive rules in place for some time now. How has that been?
Well, very similar to Cape Town. We can't go outside, for example, without a document. I mean, I'm looking out of my window here right now, and I see this idyllic Tuscan landscape, you know, with olive groves and cherry trees in blossom, hills dotted with farmhouses. But you don't need to be jealous, because I cannot go out there. No walks at all. Since the 10th, 12th of March, we've been in lockdown, complete lockdown here throughout Italy. It wasn't just the north of Italy after that. And it meant we couldn't go out, and we aren't allowed to go out still now, 200 meters beyond our house. So not even for, you know, exercise or walks or anything like that, only to the supermarket or to the pharmacy. That's all.
Wow. But could change be on the horizon, though, because Italian head Giuseppe Conte just 2 days ago on Tuesday said that Italy may be reopening beginning in early May, May 4th even.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and like an awful lot of other people here in Italy, I'm waiting on the edge of my seat to find out what exactly is going to change on the 4th of May. They're calling it phase two. Bits and pieces have been coming out, but on the whole, Giuseppe Conte has been, he's gained a lot of support during these months for the way he's organized things. Obviously, there were a lot of mistakes at the beginning, and then there was this lockdown, the clampdown, and people have behaved well during the, they've, abided by the quarantine rules. I mean, the mayors of the cities, for example, the mayor of the small town here, she's been on Facebook. She's been amazing, saying, stiamo a casa, we've got to stay at home, and getting cross if she sees any sort of sign of anything going wrong in terms of people going outside. But so people have stayed inside, but now it looks like from the 4th of May, things are going to change, but slowly. Giuseppe Conte has a task force of health experts and economic advisors, and it looks like we're going to be allowed some movement outside. Some manufacturing is going to open up. It's all going to be slow, though. They're not going to be openings of restaurants and bars, for example. Maybe not for another couple of weeks after that. And that in Italy, I mean, where I am in Florence, you know, central Italy, relies an awful lot on tourism and restaurants and bars. And actually, locals go out. You know, people go out in the evening normally, in normal times, fare una passeggiata, to go out for a drink. There's something like 50,000 bars and restaurants across Italy. Those are all people without work, without an income. And they are really worried about having to wait even longer. And then when this is what's been suggested is going to be part of the change on May the 4th, May the 11th for the restaurants, they're going to have very strict guidelines, really strict. They're going to have very thorough cleanings beforehand. And then all the tables, for example, in restaurants are going to have to be moved so that people aren't near each other. And, you know, at least 50% less in terms of capacity. So shoe shops, for example, they're not sure, you know, Italy shoes, but they're not sure that they can open shoe shops in the same way because they don't want customers near clients. So things are going to change, but slowly. And we'll hear at the end of this week, he's going to make these announcements at the end of the week about what's going to change on the 4th of May.
Interesting. So earlier this week, Conte wrote on a Facebook post that many citizens are tired of the efforts that have been made so far and would like a significant loosening of these measures or even their total abolition. A decision of that kind, though, he said, would be irresponsible. Now, Italy has been so hard hit, Anna, by the pandemic, and there is a sense of the, you know, andrà tutto bene, like everyone's going to stick together on this. But you hear Conte there reflecting is there rising frustration as well?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, there aren't protests in the way that you've seen in America. I haven't seen that, but I would say the word I'd use is antsy. People are getting a little agitated. I mean, I went just to experiment a bit, still under 200 meters from our house. I went down our little road and I bumped into our neighbor, who's a gardener at a castle up the road. And he still has a job, but he just, I spent 10 minutes 6 feet away from him, and he just was so worried about what's going to happen in the future, because the castle relies on tourism. It relies on hospitality, as they call it, tourism and hospitality. And so many businesses do. And it's as though there's been this period when people understood they had to stay inside, not go out. Things had to reduce the number of infections. But now, as people are looking into the summer and thinking, okay, what now? They're really worried about the economy. And this guy was seriously worried. He wants things to open up. But, you know, on the other hand, as I look at this, you know, hillside here, and there's a hillside, and I'll never forget this site, just a couple of weeks ago. Full cypress-lined road, and there was a military camouflage trucks going to a cemetery, and they were all coming down from Bergamo and Cremona in the north of Italy, hundreds of miles away, bringing the coffins from the north of Italy, because the north of Italy couldn't cope, the crematoria there couldn't cope with all the burials and cremations that needed to be done. And that was so moving to see that, just this silent, from here anyway, the moving of the trucks, and thinking of all those families that, you know, they were sending their loved ones away, the souls in those trucks, in those coffins, to somewhere far, far away from home. So I think that people understand there is no simple answer, but the way that Giuseppe Conte is looking at it is to take it slowly, start from the 4th of May. And he's got his advisors. It's not just him. And then, you know, and then trying to work out bit by bit how things are going to change.
Well, Anna Benstead is a longtime former journalist at our home station of WBUR and On Point's Tuscany correspondent. So, Anna Benstead, thank you so much for joining us today.
pleasure. A pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
Well, Rebecca Katz, thank you for your patience there in listening to what Anna had to say from Italy. I am curious about, you know, she is experiencing, along with tens of millions of Italians, a form of lockdown that we actually have not had here in the United States, to even have to have a permit to go outside your home or more than 200 meters outside of your home. It made me wonder, there are measures that we haven't taken here, but still could, not just those kinds of restrictive measures, but even forms of quarantine. Should those continue to be under consideration in the United States?
Well, I think everything's under consideration. I think that the decision makers in the U.S. have tried very hard to figure out how to move forward and do quarantine and do stay-at-home orders still within an American context, mm-hmm. right? So still trying to protect as much of civil liberties as possible. It has not always been possible, and clearly by definition, you know, curtailing physical movement is a curtailment of civil liberties. But I think the U.S. has tried to be very sensitive to trying to do this in a way that as much as a voluntary measure as possible. Mm.
Well, now, so can I just jump in here for a second? Because maybe let me rephrase. Because what about forms of quote unquote sort of smart isolation or smart quarantine, a la mm-hmm. what they had been doing, say in Singapore, that if you were sick but didn't need hospitalization, they still weren't going to let you quarantine at home, right? They would put you in a separate facility to be sure that you didn't spread it to your family, and they therefore would perhaps spread it to others. We haven't done that kind of thing here in the United States.
No, we have not. There has been discussion about it, but it also goes back to, you know, a lot being able to do that, asking people to separate from their families is possible in some jurisdictions, but I think that we might get more pushback, and it might be more detrimental in some of our communities than not to try to enforce that type of behavior. I also think what we're seeing, but we are though learning and watching what's happening all over the world very closely, and there are some tools that are being implemented that that are proving to be very effective, and then trying to figure out how do we translate that here and what can be adopted and what's most effective. And I think it's really important to remember that we may be doing a lot of two step forward, one step back for a while. That all of these, everything that's going to happen over the next 6 months, 8 months, maybe even up to 2 years, is going to rely on a lot of surveillance, a lot of understanding what the course of disease is looking like within our communities, and figuring out what those best practices are. And if we get to a point where it becomes incredibly clear that the only way to control this is to separate somebody from their family, well, then that's then a decision that may have to be made.
So this is an extraordinarily important point, and I was going to just ask you about it, Rebecca, but you beat me to it, that over the next, I would say 12 months, 18 months, I think you're saying that people should expect kind of an ebb and flow of restrictions as things get better in certain places. But then, as you said, we have more information or more data, or perhaps more flare-ups, a restriction put in place again. Is that going to be the rhythm of life for some time?
I mean, it may have to be. I think everybody is very hopeful that there will be the development of medical countermeasures, whether it's antivirals or better proven therapeutics, or the, you know, that thing we're all hoping for is the vaccine that's going to be perfect and save us all. But I think realistically, we understand that we may be a ways off from having all of those. The hope is that we'll have more evidence of effective therapeutics sooner rather than later. But there is even though there are many vaccine candidates that are out there that are being investigated, it may be a while. And there is also an understanding that every time you relax some of these measures, you may see flare-ups in cases. You will see flare-ups in cases if you're doing good public health, if you're doing strong surveillance and testing, and then being able to have good, visibility into what's happening within your communities. And I think this is what we're hearing from the discussions in Italy, from discussions all over the world, that you take action, and then you have to adapt as the epidemiology of the virus changes, and we see what's happening. And we're seeing that, say, first in Singapore, mm-hmm. that didn't take, was able to use just really strong public health measures and didn't have the kind of wholesale lockdown in society that we've seen in other parts of the world. But now that they are seeing increases in cases, particularly in migrant population and dormitories, they're now taking some of the actions that they hadn't done before. So they are now shutting schools. They're now being more aggressive. And that just might be what happens over the course of the next year. And we're just going to have to be careful.
Yeah, and that's in a place where there was a robust public health infrastructure ready to respond to a pandemic already in place, which, as you said earlier, we don't necessarily have here. And hopefully we can build it in real time as this pandemic grinds on. But Rebecca, I wanted to circle back to where we started about what you said 6 weeks ago and last time you were on the show. So I just want to play this moment for you where you talked about, again, this was on March 10th, the uniqueness of this historical moment.
What people should remember is that our public health communities haven't had to make these types of decisions at this type of scale in, again, approximately 100 years. I mean, we've had other threats. There are other threats that thankfully haven't been as challenging as this, or have had other parameters that we were able to manage. But this is bringing us into a new world, and it means that there's not a massive evidence base that we can be drawing on for all of these decisions.
Rebecca, that was you back on March 10th. I would say there's a growing mass of evidence for a new base now. We've got about a minute left to go. I mean, what are you learning? What are you thinking in this moment?
Wow. Well, when I talked about the evidence base, I mean, I think we're still collecting data. We're still trying to analyze. We're still trying to figure out what are the best practices. And I think every decision maker is doing that at every level. So, you know, we're now talking about contact tracing. Well, what's the best way that we do contact tracing? Do we use kind of new apps and interesting technology that's being put forward? Do we use armies of basically the equivalent of community health workers who are going out? Is it some type of combination of that? So we learn more every day. And the hope is that every day we're going to get better at this.
And we're putting that knowledge, hopefully, into practice every day, right? So the cycle between learning and measuring is as fast as it's ever been on this subject. So Rebecca Katz, director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's been researching quarantines for the past 10 years. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming back to speak with us. And maybe we'll, in another 6 weeks, let's do this again.
Thanks for having me.
And folks, tomorrow it is our Friday Week in Review, yet another big week in the news. We want to hear from you. What are you feeling about reopening the economy right now? How do you measure the response that's been coming out of Washington or from your state's governor? Give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's Week in Review. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.